Chapter 20. Archer had no heart to go on pleading with her. He was too much disappointed at the vanishing of the new being who had cast that one deep look at him from her transparent eyes. May seemed to be aware of his disappointment, but without knowing how to alleviate it, and they stood up and walked silently home. XVII. Your cousin the Countess called on Mother while you were away, Janie Archer announced to her brother on the evening of his return. The young man, who was dining alone with his mother and sister, glanced up in surprise and saw Mrs. Archer's gaze demurely bent on her plate. Mrs. Archer did not regard her seclusion from the world as a reason for being forgotten by it, and Newland guessed that she was slightly annoyed that he should be surprised by Madame Olenska's visit. As he had on a black velvet polonaise with jet buttons, and a tiny green monkey muff. I never saw her so stylishly dressed, Janie continued. He came alone, early on Sunday afternoon. Luckily the fire was lit in the drawing room. As he had one of those new card cases. She said she wanted to know us, because you'd been so good to her. Newland laughed. A Dame Olenska always takes that tone about her friends. She's very happy at being among her own people again. Yes, so she told us, said Mrs. Archer. Must say she seems thankful to be here. I hope you liked her, Mother. Mrs. Archer drew her lips together. He certainly lays herself out to please, even when she is calling on an old lady. Mother doesn't think her simple, Janie interjected, her eyes screwed upon her brother's face. It's just my old-fashioned feeling. Dear May is my ideal, said Mrs. Archer. Ah, said her son, they're not alike. Archer had left St. Augustine charged with many messages for old Mrs. Mingott, and a day or two after his return to town he called on her. The old lady received him with unusual warmth. She was grateful to him for persuading the Countess Olenska to give up the idea of a divorce. And when he told her that he had deserted the office without leave, and rushed down to St. Augustine simply because he wanted to see May, she gave an Oedipus chuckle, and patted his knee with her puffball hand. Ah, so you kicked over the traces, did you? And I suppose Augusta and Welland pulled long faces, and behaved as if the end of the world had come? But little May, she knew better, I'll be bound. I hoped she did. But after all she wouldn't agree to what I'd gone down to ask for. Wouldn't she indeed? And what was that? I wanted to get her to promise that we should be married in April. What's the use of our wasting another year? Mrs. Manson Mingott screwed up her little mouth into a grimace of mimic prudery and twinkled at him through malicious lids. Ask Mama, apostrophe I suppose the usual story. Ah, these Mingotts all alike. Born in a rut, and you can't root them out of it. When I built this house you'd have thought I was moving to California. Nobody ever had built above 40th Street, no, says I, nor above the Battery either, before Christopher Columbus discovered America. No, not one of them wants to be different. They're as scared of it as the smallpox. Ah, my dear Mr. Archer, I thank my stars I'm nothing but a vulgar spicer. But there's not one of my own children that takes after me, but my little Ellen. She broke off, still twinkling at him, and asked, with the casual irrelevance of old age, Oh, why in the world didn't you marry my little Ellen? Archer laughed. Or one thing, she wasn't there to be married. No, to be sure, more's the pity. And now it's too late, her life is finished. She spoke with the cold, dash-blooded complacency of the aged throwing earth into the grave of young hopes. The young man's heart grew chill, and he said hurriedly, And I persuade you to use your influence with the Wellands, Mrs. Mingott? I wasn't made for long engagements. Old Catherine beamed on him approvingly. Oh, I can see that. You've got a quick eye. When you were a little boy I've no doubt you liked to be helped first. She threw back her head with a laugh that made her chins ripple like little waves. H, here's my Ellen now, she exclaimed, as the portieres parted behind her. Madame Olenska came forward with a smile. Her face looked vivid and happy, and she held out her hand gaily to Archer while she stooped to her grandmother's kiss. I was just saying to him, my dear. Why didn't you marry my little Ellen? Madame Olenska looked at Archer, still smiling. Andy, what did he answer? Oh, my darling, I leave you to find that out. He's been down to Florida to see his sweetheart. Yes, I know. She still looked at him. Went to see your mother, to ask where you'd gone. I sent a note that you never answered, and I was afraid you were ill. He muttered something about leaving unexpectedly, in a great hurry, and having intended to write to her from St. Augustine. And of course once you were there you never thought of me again. She continued to beam on him with a gaiety that might have been a studied assumption of indifference. If she still needs me, she's determined not to let me see it, he thought, stung by her manner. He wanted to thank her for having been to see his mother, but under the ancestress's malicious eye he felt himself tongue-dashed, tied and constrained. Look at him in such hot haste to get married, that he took French leave and rushed down to implore the silly girl on his knees. That's something like a lover, that's the way handsome Bob Spicer carried off my poor mother, and then got tired of her, before I was weaned, though they only had to wait 8 months for me. But there, you're not a Spicer, young man. Luckily for you and for me. It's only my poor Ellen that has kept any of their wicked blood. The rest of them are all model mingots, cried the old lady scornfully. Archer was aware that Madame Olenska, who had seated herself at her grandmother's side, was still thoughtfully scrutinizing him. The gaiety had faded from her eyes, and she said with great gentleness, Surely, Granny, we can persuade them between us to do as he wishes. Archer rose to go, and as his hand met Madame Olenska's he felt that she was waiting for him to make some allusion to her unanswered letter. When can I see you? He asked, as she walked with him to the door of the room. Whenever you like, but it must be soon if you want to see the little house again. I am moving next week. A pang shot through him at the memory of his lamplit hours in the low-studded drawing room. Few as they had been, they were thick with memories. Tomorrow evening? She nodded. Tomorrow, yes, but early. I'm going out. The next day was a Sunday, and if she were going out on a Sunday evening it could, of course, be only to Mrs. Lemuel Struthers. He felt a slight movement of annoyance, not so much at her going there, for he rather liked her going, where she pleased in spite of the van der Luydens, but because it was the kind of house at which she was sure to meet Beaufort, where she must have known beforehand that she would meet him and where she was probably going for that purpose. Very well, tomorrow evening, he repeated, inwardly resolved that he would not go early, and that by reaching her door Lady would either prevent her from going to Mrs. Struthers, or else arrive after as he had started, which, all things considered, would no doubt be the simplest solution. It was only 8:30, after all, when he rang the bell under the wisteria. Not as late as he had intended by 30 minutes, but a singular restlessness had driven him to her door. He reflected, however, that Mrs. Struthers' Sunday evenings were not like a ball, and that her guests, as if to minimize their delinquency, usually went early. The one thing he had not counted on, in entering Madame Olenska's hall, was to find hats and overcoats there. Why had she bidden him to come early, if she was having people to dine? On a closer inspection of the garments besides which Nastasia was laying his own, his resentment gave way to curiosity. The overcoats were in fact the very strangest he had ever seen under a polite roof, and it took but a glance to assure himself that neither of them belonged to Julius Beaufort. One was a shaggy yellow ulster of each-me-down cut, the other a very old and rusty cloak with a cape, something like what the French called a McFarlane. This garment, which appeared to be made for a person of prodigious size, had evidently seen long and hard wear, and its greenish black folds gave out a moist salt-moldy smell suggestive of prolonged sessions against barroom walls. On it lay a ragged gray scarf, and an odd felt hat of semi-clerical shape. Archer raised his eyebrows inquiringly at Nastasia, who raised hers in return with a fatalistic eye, as she threw open the drawing room door. The young man saw at once that his hostess was not in the room. Then, with surprise, he discovered another lady standing by the fire. This lady, who was long, lean and loosely put together, was clad in raiment intricately looped and fringed, with plaits and stripes and bands of plain color disposed in a design to which the clue seemed missing. Her hair, which had tried to turn white, and only succeeded in fading, was surmounted by a Spanish comb and black lace scarf, and silk mittens, visibly darned, covered her rheumatic hands. Beside her, in a cloud of cigar smoke, stood the owners of the two overcoats, both in morning clothes, that they had evidently not taken off since morning. In one of the two, Archer, to his surprise, recognized Ned Winsett, the other and older, who was unknown to him, and whose gigantic frame declared him to be the wearer of the McFarlane, had a feebly leonine head with crumpled gray hair, and moved his arms with large pawing gestures, as though he were distributing lay blessings to a kneeling multitude. These three persons stood together on the hearth-rug, their eyes fixed on an extraordinarily large bouquet of crimson roses, with a knot of purple pansies at their base, that lay on the sofa, where Madame Olenska usually sat. What they must have cost at this season, though of course it's the sentiment one cares about, the lady was saying in a sighing staccato as Archer came in. The three turned with surprise at his appearance, and the lady, advancing, held out her hand. "Dear Mr. Archer, almost my cousin Newland," she said. "I'm the Marchioness Manson." Archer bowed, and she continued. "Why, Ellen has taken me in for a few days. I came from Cuba, where I have been spending the winter with Spanish friends, such delightful, distinguished people. The highest nobility of Old Castle, how I wish you could know them. But I was called away by our dear great friend here, Dr. Carver. You don't know Dr. Agathon Carver, founder of the Valley of Love community?" Dr. Carver inclined his leonine head, and the Marchioness continued. "New York, New York, how little the life of the spirit has reached it. But I see you do know Mr. Winsett." "Oh, yes, I reached him some time ago, but not by that route," Winsett said with his dry smile. The Marchioness shook her head reprovingly. "How do you know, Mr. Winsett? The spirit bloweth where it listeth." "List, oh, list," interjected Dr. Carver in a stentorian murmur. "But do sit down, Mr. Archer. We four have been having a delightful little dinner together, and my child?" Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.